Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin with a land and ancestor acknowledgement. I acknowledge that we are on stolen land that belongs to our Dakota relatives. I invite myself and all of us non-Indigenous participants to consider what we might do to support the efforts of our Dakota relatives in the here and now. I acknowledge that we live in a country that holds a legacy of the slavery of Black people. I encourage myself and all white participants to consider what we might do to transform the karma of white supremacy. I acknowledge that the very Buddhism I practice has often been taught without acknowledgement of the Indian, Chinese, and Japanese spiritual ancestors. And I encourage myself and others to continue to acknowledge this history and to examine what we might do in the present to make amends. So, the title of my talk today is Juneteenth and Freedom. But before I formally begin, I just want to acknowledge that I'm feeling a little unsettled this morning, as it appears that the United States is going to war with Iran, and that's unsettling. And I'm sitting with my feelings about that, with my unsettledness, and trying to sit in the big picture. And that's also what I'm going to be talking about today, with freedom and Juneteenth. So this is a little bit of a, well, actually, let me pause for just a minute, because I have a feeling I'm not the only one who's unsettled. So we can just sit for a moment and just, maybe you've already been doing this for half an hour, but just another invitation to just let the whatever, to me it feels kind of like a lump in my heart and my gut, to just allow that to be there, acknowledge it, breathe with it, not try to make it go away, but also perhaps remembering that that's not all there is. Thank you. So this is a little combo of a history lesson and a Dharma talk. And I think probably a lot of people already know, I hope, that you've done some, you know, sort of educating yourself about Juneteenth, but I thought I knew something and I looked up some more things, and so I want to just share a few things, and it's kind of in the form of sort of a timeline. So as you know, Juneteenth, it's officially Juneteenth National Independence Day. That was June 19th, Thursday. And it is a federal holiday in the United States as of 2021. And it commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. And I'll say more about that. So in the Civil War period, slavery came to an end at different times in different areas of the U.S. Many enslaved Southerners escaped and demanded wages, stopped work, or took up arms against the Confederacy of Slave States. In January 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, declaring all persons held as slaves within any state that's in rebellion against the United States, and then here's a quote, shall be thenceforth and forever free, unquote. So this proclamation did not end slavery in the nation, since it only applied to the areas of the Confederacy currently in a state of rebellion. And, you know, one might think, like, okay, this was kind of a strategic move, like, for the Union to win the war, let's get the slaves to be fighting for the Union. So, anyway, perhaps mixed motivations there. So it wasn't until 2 years later that the 13th Amendment ending slavery for the whole nation was passed by Congress. And then, even then, it wasn't yet part of the Constitution because it hadn't been ratified by the states. So that was January 1865. Then the Civil War ended. The Union won in April of 1865. And on June 19th, 1865, news of the congressional passage of the 13th Amendment finally reached the island of Galveston, Texas, the very last place to get the word. At least that's what we think. That's the story. So, even though the Emancipation Proclamation was in 1863, even though the 13th Amendment was in January of 1865, it wasn't until June of 1865 that some people got the word of this. Then in December of 1865, the 13th Amendment was ratified by the required three-fourths of the states. And at that time, there were still some remaining enslaved people in Delaware and in Kentucky, and so they were free at that point. So Juneteenth is 1866, 1 year after Galveston got the news. That's the first Juneteenth commemorative celebration in Galveston. And then it spread to the rest of Texas and to the rest of the country, the South, and then the rest of the country. The early celebrations were church-centered. In the 1920s and 30s, the celebrations, it kind of changed, a little more secular, or somewhere Red said commercialized, but it's like, well, I don't know, just anyway. They weren't church-centered, and often they took the form of food festivals, so celebrating, you know, coming together, nourishing each other for formerly enslaved black people to be able to celebrate resilience. In 1938, Texas officially recognized the holiday by proclamation. So the holiday had been happening informally, but it was officially recognized in Texas by proclamation. And 1938. In the 1960s, Juneteenth celebrations were eclipsed by the Civil Rights Movement. So anyway, kind of like, well, we were freed, but somehow we're still not free, so let's work to get free before we celebrate. And in the 1970s, the Juneteenth became popular again, and the focus was on African-American freedom and African-American arts, often. Then in 1979, the Texas legislature passed a bill to recognize the holiday. So now it becomes really an official state holiday. It's not just like a proclamation, but it's a state holiday. But even before it was recognized as a federal holiday in 2021, every state in the U.S. and the District of Columbia had formally recognized Juneteenth in some way. And today, often, Juneteenth is celebrated with food, with music, dance, readings, speeches, parades, so it takes many forms. There were several festivals, even in St. Paul, one at the state capitol, and there was also one in, where is Penumbra located? That park?
Rondo Park.
Rondo. Okay. I didn't get to a festival this year, but I want to commemorate the day, Juneteenth, by giving this talk about freedom. And I'd like to start, because readings was one of the things, and African-American arts, so I'd like to start with reading this famous poem by Maya Angelou. And then also ending with some words by Katagiri Roshi, the honorary founder of this temple, who came from Japan and talked about freedom. So that's the connection. So the poem by Maya Angelou, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but we can hear it again, is Caged Bird. A free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the current ends and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze and the trade winds soft through the singing, sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on a dawn bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams. His shadow shouts on a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. I chose this poem because the longing for freedom is still here. And the song of freedom still needs to be sung. And the legacy of slavery is not over. Its effects are still strongly felt in the race-based discrimination in employment, housing, healthcare, voter suppression, and more. In a real way, slavery continues through the biased application of our criminal justice system, resulting in disproportionate enslavement of Black people in our nation. In Buddhism, we talk about the relative truth and the absolute truth. In the relative truth, the bird is still caged. News of the congressional and constitutional abolition of slavery has reached us, but the reality of slavery is still here. And it's not only Black people who are trapped. Our civil rights are being eroded. We're celebrating Pride this month, but many of our LGBTQIA+ community members don't feel free. Immigrants are afraid. In a lot of ways, we may say we are not free. That's the relative truth, and that's part of the, like, my inviting us to sit with the lump of unsettled that we might feel for various things that are happening. That's being with the relative truth. In the world of the relative truth, we can and should sing of freedom. We can and should have a dream of a world in which we are all treated equitably. And we can and should work. We can and should work to make this happen. And as Buddhists, we can and should remember that there is another truth, the absolute truth. And the absolute truth, I just want to say, because, you know, I and many of us think the relative truth is here, and then, oh, if the absolute truth is here, that they're fighting each other. But in Buddhism, because it doesn't always follow linear logic, we have the relative truth and the absolute truth, but then the absolute truth includes the absolute truth and the relative truth together. So that's something that's kind of hard for our linear mind to wrap around. That's why sometimes we need to sit in silence with Zazen to see if that can, if we can touch that truth. So touch that place where the particulars of our joys and suffering and the boundless openness of true freedom can interbe. So it's for help in understanding that truth that I'd like to share a little bit from a talk by Katagiri Roshi. So this is once again from the Katagiri Transcripts website. Thank you, Kikan. And this is from it's from a talk on the Blue Cliff Record Case 36. Khan Shah Wandering in the Mountains, and it's the second talk. He gave two talks, two long talks. So I'm just giving a few excerpts from that second talk. But I am going to read the case from the Blue Cliff Record, and then the verse that's the case, you know, was followed the case, and the his talk was on the verse, and then I'll share a few things from that. So the case goes like this. One day, Kang Sha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate of the temple, the head monk asks, "Where are you coming from, master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." So to me, right there, that sounds like freedom. And I'll just point out one little thing, which is pursuing the fragrant grasses is a little like, oh, the smells of spring, oh, the beautiful flowers. So like, yes. And then return following the falling flowers. So this is when the flowers wilt. Like, we have new flowers here, which we have every Friday, thanks to our flower team. But usually by like Friday morning, they're a little bit falling. So it's like being with the, oh, I want this, it's beautiful, it's lovely, and being with the, oh, now things are dying. That's freedom. And then the verse from the case goes like this. "The earth is clear of any dust. Whose eyes do not open? First he went following the fragrant grasses. Then he returned pursuing the falling flowers. A weary crane alights on a withered tree. A mad monkey cries on the ancient terrace. Chang Sha's boundless meaning. Bah." I said it like that softly. It wasn't like, bah. Bah. What else can be said? So the earth is clear of any dust. Now this is from Katagiri. The case talked about Kang Sha's perfect freedom in his life. That freedom is coming from the earth is clear of any dust. That is Buddha's world. Plainly speaking, we say equality or perfect peace or Buddha's land where there is no discrimination between subject and object. All exist in peace and harmony, relating to each other, helping each other, giving to each other perfectly, no trouble, no misunderstanding. This is Buddha's world, and Buddha's world is exactly identical with the original nature of existence, where you are present from moment to moment. That is real reality. And a bit later, he goes on to say, if you think, I am Buddha, or you could say, I'm living in this Buddha world of perfect peace, but I'm not Buddha now. Like, I don't see this world of perfect peace now. So I want to be Buddha, or I want that world by practice. So I'm coming to a Zen center, sitting meditation, chanting, being mindful. Katagiri says, this is really dualistic thinking, because at that time, Buddha is already your object. But in Buddha's land, the real reality, object and subject are completely equal. That is why you are always emphasizing peace and equality. Why do you want to have peace right in the middle of the human world? I think it's a rhetorical question. And then because there was a lot going on at that time that he gave this talk around the nuclear proliferation. Wow, it's coming back around. So he says, right in the middle of nuclear races between human beings, human races. It's a question, why do you want peace in the middle of that? Or how can there be peace in the middle of that? He says, real peace means whatever kind of race you belong to, you as a human being must be peaceful. And I kind of got this, I'm not sure, but when I read this, I saw it as sort of a double meaning of race. Like it's race about, you know, how we identify, you know, black, white, indigenous. But it's also, like he's saying, the nuclear race, that, you know, like we're trying, you know, we're making all this effort. So whatever kind of race you belong to, you as a human being must be peaceful. That means whatever you may be or whoever you are exactly in equality. That is peace. That is a state of human life you are present in from moment to moment, regardless of whether you are conscious of it or not. That's an important piece, whether you are conscious of it or not. And he goes on to say, karmic life is always leading you to really grasp and attach. So these are the causes and conditions in our life. When he says karmic life, that's one way to think about karmic life. It's always leading you to really grasp and attach. It's like a human life. The way our brains work, always leading us to grasp and attach. He says, if you do something good, you really attach strongly. If you do something wrong, you don't want to do it, so you try to forget it. But still, trying to forget is already attachment. So it's like attachment in a different way, like I don't want it, attaching to that. Whatever you do, you always attach because you look at your life according to your telescope. So when he often used this image of telescope. So you might think, telescope, oh, pretty good. You can see into the distance. But the problem with telescope is that you can see into the distance, but then you only see a tiny part of the whole picture. And that's usually how we look at things. It's just a tiny part. So he says, so an important point is, in the Buddha's world, you cannot attach to your doings. But without your body and mind, without your karmic life, you cannot live in Buddha's world. So you have to live your life with your karmic life. But the important point is, you have to take care of your life, not in the realm of karmic life, but in the Buddha's world. So this is kind of hard for us. And sometimes I'll just say, sometimes we need to take care of our life in the particular world, in the so-called karmic world, sometimes that's important to like see, oh, I'm, I fell and hurt myself, I need to go to the urgent care, you know, something like that. So sometimes there's a taking care of it like that. But other times there is a taking care of it that's the big picture, from the point of view of the big picture. And that's especially helpful when it's things that we can't do anything about immediately, like the U.S. bombing Iran. We can't do anything about it immediately, so we can take a pause and invite ourselves to live in Buddha's world. And then we return to the human world, and maybe we can do something. But we're taking care of it from that very big picture. He says, if you do it that way, he says, that way you cannot attach to any sense of good or bad, right or wrong, because Buddha's world is exactly limpid, pure, clean. I had to look up limpid. It's a great word. So for those who don't know, it usually refers to a liquid, and it means free of anything that darkens or completely clear. So it's like water. The sense of a liquid flowing, flexible, and clean and clear, and you can see clearly. Beautiful. Great word. He says, it's not something that is a matter of discussion. You have to do something good. At that time, just do something. So sometimes you just do something. From moment to moment, just do. So I'm not going to be able to, he goes line by line through the whole verse, and I'm not going to get through the whole verse, but let me just share a few other tidbits from that verse that I can share with you. So the next line was, so if you remember, the verse was, the earth is clear of any dust, whose eyes do not open. First he went following the fragrant grasses, then he returned pursuing the falling flowers. That's as far as I'm going to get, so I'll just leave the rest off for it, unless there's questions, if we have time. So, whose eyes do not open? Katagiri says about that one, everyone's eyes are already open. So, like the question in the verse is, it's again a rhetorical question, whose eyes do not open? And no one's eyes do not open, everyone's eyes are already open. And then he says, so whose eyes do not open? Is there a particular person whose eyes should be open? And then there's another Zen master, because often in these koans there's like, you know, the person who, you know, the story is about, and then it was written down, and then other people comment on it, and that's all included in the collection. So it says, Engo Zen master's note is about this line. One must emit a great radiant light from his forehead before this is possible. So whose eyes do not open? One must emit a great radiant light from their forehead before this is possible. And Katagiri says, from our karmic life, we immediately say, is it possible? Probably like, it's not possible, is it possible? Well, Katagiri says, well, before we say it is possible or not, we are already illuminated from right here, between the eyebrows. That means you are already greatness of existence, beyond human speculation, human judgment, human evaluation, good or bad, right or wrong. So from moment to moment in this realm, we have to realize it, we have to taste it, we have to act on it. And then, first he went following the fragrant grasses, Katagiri says. If you act in Buddha's realm, very naturally, there is one type of practice. That is egolessness. It means you have to tune the dial into the rhythm of the truth, not the rhythm of your karmic life. You have to seek for the truth constantly. And then he returned, pursuing the falling flowers. Katagiri says, it means you cannot always be in paradise after seeking for the truth. You have to descend to the human world. But on the other hand, You cannot always leave a trace of being in the human world because you have to seek for the truth. So earlier he talked a lot about the leaving a trace or not leaving a trace, and I had skipped over that, but basically it's doing the activity without like mucking it up, without like getting your ego really attached and involved. So, but then he says, we need both practices. Just seek for the truth, but simultaneously you should live in the human world. But if you open your eyes widely, you have to be involved in the human world too much. At that time, you're already confused. He says, so you should open your eyes just half. And communicate with the human world seeking for the truth. And that's actually lovely because it's a reference to, in our form of meditation, the classic posture of the eyes is half open with the downward gaze and kind of being really aware of the visual field without being like attached to like, what is this, what is that, what is the other? It's just like, here I am and things are going on. And then sometimes when you're sitting like that, like when we used to, way back, we were sitting for peace in Mears Park. I don't even remember what war it was. Some of us were sitting there, and I remember crabapple blossoms were falling. It was very beautiful. And we were sitting with eyes half open because sometimes someone would come up and confront us. And you needed to be aware if, like, there was needed to be an engagement. And or maybe there's a safety issue, so you need to be aware. So anyway, I just love that. If your eyes are open widely, that means, you know, getting too involved in the human world. So you need to be somewhat involved, but just half. So I think we have, what, a couple minutes?
I don't have my clock.
It's
10:09. Okay. So. Well, you could go to 10:18 if you have more.
Okay. So, are there any questions? Yes, Keika.
I love this talk.
Speak loudly,
yes.
Too. So
oh, okay.
Thanks. Switch the
camera.
Will
you say something about imagination? Like, it feels to me when you're talking about like the real world and then the absolute world, or the caged bird and the free bird. Mm-hmm. Is there some way where we like, when we're caged, we need to imagine freedom, but it's, how is that different than just like dreaming or getting off our, how do you say, like, yeah, getting off our cushion or something like that, like getting unmoored?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I kind of see, thank you for that question. So the question is imagination important? And then if it is, or if we're being invited to imagine, like the caged bird singing, then how do we, how does that not become us being unmoored and like lost? So I really think imagination is very important. And I kind of see imagination can be in the relative and in the absolute. So in the relative, imagination is like really, you know, sort of concrete imagining. And it might even be like imagining, how can I find the key to open up the lock of the cage and get out, you know? So that might be an imagining. And then there's the imagining of, it's beyond words, and it's beyond right and wrong, and it's beyond free or caged. And that's the absolute truth or the freedom that's everywhere. Like, we're already free. So that part, you know, that is maybe imagining, I could imagine that realization might be possible for me, even if I don't feel like it's true now. And that's where Kadigiri says, whether you are aware of it or not. So I think the two kinds of imagination are important. Thank you. Oh, yes.
And I'm also thinking inquiry. Mm-hmm. So not, you know, being in a trapped situation,
sometimes requires the prisoner to capitulate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, an inquiry of how am I also participating in this prison,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think imagination, yeah, they kind of go together. Like,
yeah.
you can imagine and then you start inquiry. And,
right.
Yeah.
And then there's a back and forth, too. So the inquiring would be like, okay, I'm maybe supporting this prison by capitulating. So I could imagine, like, that's not good. Maybe I could say that. And then if I go back to, let's just say, Buddha's world or this absolute truth, and rest there, then maybe I come forward again, and maybe I see, like, in this particular case, capitulation is mm-hmm. what is called for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I usually I'd say no, you know, like, stand up for what you believe. But sometimes it's like being strategic, is like, how is this fitting into the overall picture of things, and how will it be? What is the best way to prevent harm going forward? So it's not really just so easy. But then I also appreciated Katagiri saying that about just do. So like you can, I forget where he said that, but anyway, it's like there's right and wrong, thinking about that, that's in the relative world, there's the Buddhist world, beyond right and wrong, and then you're wanting to do something good, but you're not wanting to attach to it, and in the end, just do. And you just, at some point, you just have to take action. And maybe it's not the best action, but it's the best that you can do in that moment. So you just do it. And I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because I just love it. I don't remember what talk this is from. I think I just heard it secondhand. It was, Katagiri was doing a Q&A, and someone asked, and it was about ego, you know, attachment to ego. And someone said, I was coming here to the Zen Center, that was Minnesota Zen Center, today, and I saw a piece of paper, you know, trash on the ground. And I was going to pick it up. And then I noticed that myself was like, oh, I'm a good person picking up this trash. I hope someone sees me pick it up. You know, like that started going. And then it's like, oh, so I'm attached to that. Maybe I should, you know, not pick it up, because not picking it up would be letting go. And he just, the questioner kind of went on and on and then stopped. And then Katagiri says, pick up the paper. So sometimes you just go and do it, even if there's attachment. Anything else?
I can.
Okay, yes.
I really, really appreciated the Juneteenth. I just don't think it can ever be too much to hear the stories and to be moved by them.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Fort Snelling and heard all sorts of stories about slavery that was being carried on in the army.
Yeah.
You know, and in a quote free state, it was shocking to me. And that fact that I'm right living now and being shocked by this is its own story right
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So I thank you.
Yeah. So educating ourselves is a very good thing. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Stay cool.
Thank you, Sosan, for your talk.
Mm-hmm.